Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Right to Competence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 9, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Tibbles v. Carter and Ryan v. Gonzalez. These death penalty cases consider the scope of the right to counsel and federal habeas proceedings where the convicted individual's mental competency is at issue. The question in Tibbles v. Carter is whether a capital prisoner possesses a right to competence in federal habeas proceedings under the Supreme Court's 1966 decision in Reese v. Payton. The analogous question in Ryan v. Gonzalez is whether state inmates' right to counsel in habeas proceedings, where the underlying offense was a capital offense, includes a right to stay of habeas proceedings when the inmate is not competent to assist counsel. To discuss the case, we have Ron Eisenberg, who is the Deputy District Attorney for the Law Division at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Eisenberg.
A criminal defendant cannot be tried by a court if the defendant is not mentally competent to understand the charges and assist with his defense. But what about during the defendant's habeas corpus appeal? Sometimes those appeals take place 5 or 10 or even 20 years later. Does the court have to find that the defendant is mentally competent at that stage to assist with the complex legal arguments that comprise federal habeas corpus review? That's the issue in two cases recently argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, Tibbles v. Carter and Ryan v. Gonzalez. Lower federal courts in two states, Arizona and Ohio, decided that defendants do have a so-called right to competency during habeas corpus proceedings. And if the defendant is deemed not competent to understand and assist in those proceedings, the habeas appeal is put on hold indefinitely, possibly forever, until the defendant regains competency. The government says this is wrong. Of course, the defendant has to be mentally competent at the time of trial. That's always been the law. But habeas corpus appeals are lawyers' work. There's really nothing for the defendant himself to do. The record is long closed by that point. There's seldom, if ever, any new question of fact, just a lot of highly specialized, esoteric arguments about constitutional criminal procedure. But why does anybody care about this question about mental competency in habeas corpus appeals? Why would the defendant want to put his appeal on hold indefinitely? And why would the prosecution mind if he did? The answer, as is often the case with habeas issues, is the death penalty. In death penalty cases, all the incentives are upside down. The defendant doesn't usually want the appeal decided. He wants the appeal delayed because the execution can't be carried out until the appeal is over. So when a court puts the appeal on hold indefinitely, that's as good as an indefinite stay of execution. Not surprisingly, the federal courts that have established this competency delay rule happen to be the Ninth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit, two of the three most liberal appeals courts when it comes to capital punishment. Both Tibbles and Ryan are death penalty defendants. Tibbles was sentenced to death for beating, anally raping, and stabbing to death his own grandmother. Ryan was sentenced to death for killing a man and stabbing his wife because they had the audacity to interrupt him while he was burglarizing their home. Both defendants were tried and convicted in the 1990s. Both lost their state court appeals. Both have now delayed their federal habeas appeals for the last 10 years by virtue of alleged incompetency. The fact that the Supreme Court granted review in both of these cases looked like a sign that the competency delay rule might be in trouble. But the briefs and oral arguments put things in a very different light, primarily because of striking concessions made by each side. First, there was the defendants. Remarkably, both Tibbles and Ryan refused to defend the rationales of the circuit courts that had granted them stays. In Tibbles' case, the Sixth Circuit had relied on a federal statute, Title 18, Section 4241, which governs claims of incompetency at the trial stage by federal criminal defendants. The Sixth Circuit held that this statute implied a right to delays for state criminal defendants claiming incompetency on habeas corpus appeals. In Ryan's case, the Ninth Circuit relied on an entirely different federal statute, Title 18, Section 3599, which governs the right to counsel on habeas corpus appeals by state capital defendants. The Ninth Circuit held that this was the statute that implied a right to delays for state criminals claiming incompetency at the habeas stage. When they got to the U.S. Supreme Court, however, neither defendant wanted to stand on the grounds on which they had won below. Instead, they both claimed that federal habeas courts have inherent discretion to control their dockets and can continue a habeas proceeding, if necessary, to wait for a witness to become available. They should be able to do the same thing in order to wait for the habeas petitioner to become available by regaining mental competency. This switch by the defendants made sense. The statutory analysis by the circuit courts was a stretch and was unlikely to win over a majority of the Supreme Court, which has regularly reversed both the Sixth and the Ninth in recent habeas cases. The new defense position invoked the general authority of federal judges, an approach that is likely to have some attraction to other federal judges. Meanwhile, the states were making a concession of their own. Both Ohio and Arizona argued that, in many habeas cases, there should be no stay at all because the record is already closed and there was no need for the defendant's personal participation. But both states agreed that in other cases, stays would be appropriate. To be sure, habeas courts should not grant indefinite stays, like the ones granted in these two cases, but a federal habeas court could legitimately stay the proceedings for 6 to 9 months or even up to about a year in order to determine whether the defendant would be competent to proceed. The state's position was understandable. It's seldom easy to get 5 votes at the Supreme Court, and you never really know in advance who's going to be on your side. So a more moderate position often makes sense. The states also had to worry about the federal government, which participated in the case as an amicus curiae and might have marginalized the states had they taken a more extreme approach. But the consequence of all this positioning was that there wasn't all that much daylight between any of the 4 parties before the court. The court spent most of the 2 hours of oral argument trying to come up with a more precise standard for identifying which cases would be eligible for a competency stay, and a more precise number for the length of such a stay. And maybe, if the court's decision focuses on those questions, this will be a minor precedent with a little something for both sides. For the states, there will be a ruling precluding competency delays in at least one class of federal habeas appeals. These would be cases where the defendant's claims were decided on their merits in state court, where the record is therefore closed by the time the case reaches federal court, and where it is unlikely that the defendant's input could affect the outcome of the habeas petition. For the defendants, there will be official endorsement of the concept of competency delays. Federal courts will have to make a determination about whether the defendant's personal participation in the proceedings is necessary, and if it is, a claim of incompetency will bring those proceedings to a halt, at least for 6 or 12 months. The capital appeals process, which already stretches out over a decade or two, will be slowed down by another year. But maybe not. Maybe these cases will not be decided along these lines, because there were some brief glimpses at oral argument suggesting that the court is not entirely happy with this sort of resolution and may not be willing to go down the road prepared by the parties. There was, for example, a point made by Justice Kennedy. Why have competency delays at all in any habeas case? Why not just decide the habeas petition as is, and if the defendant later becomes competent and claims he has some important new factual claim that only he would have known, let him file a new habeas petition. The habeas statute does provide for the filing of a second petition when previously unavailable facts are discovered. As the defense pointed out, however, the statutory standard for filing a second petition requires more than new facts. The petitioner also has to show a likelihood that he is actually innocent. But so what? Why does that entitle the petitioner to avoid the second petition standard by delaying the first petition until he is available to assert new facts? After all, everyone else who discovers new facts later on has to comply with the second petition standard. Why should the rule be different just because the defendant says the reason for the late discovery is because he was incompetent, rather than some other good reason, such as the development of a new scientific test? There was also another point made by more than one justice. Why are we even talking about how long competency stays should be? Weren't stays of any length improper in the two cases actually before the court? In both cases, state courts had previously decided the merits of the claims now being raised on federal habeas review. That meant, under the court's landmark precedent in Cullen v. Pinholster, that the factual record would be closed and that the federal court would have to review the claims based only on the facts that were before the state court. Given that limitation, neither Tibbles nor Ryan has been able to articulate any particular reason why their lawyers needed them in order to prepare legal arguments in federal court. So, under the approach taken by the parties, neither defendant was really entitled to a competency stay. Any discussion of the basis or boundaries of a stay for some other defendant would be dictum, and the resolution of those questions would have to await a future case. That would be the smallest decision the court could render here, but it may be the most likely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.